Indicated, we're going to eventually work our way to 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 12 and 13 in the lesson tonight, but I want to sort of get there gradually. I want us to back up and to establish a context and a foundation that I think will help us perhaps appreciate those two verses a little better. We've made the observation several times now in talking about the topical construction of the book of 1 Corinthians, that certain chapters go together as Paul is addressing one particular topic here and one particular topic there. And if we don't appreciate that construction, it's fairly easy to take some passages out of context and apply them in a way that Paul really didn't intend. So I think contextual awareness is extremely important in our Bible studies. And we've noted that chapters 8, 9, and 10 of 1 Corinthians really are addressing one idea primarily, and that is that the Corinthians were not quite ready yet to completely sever their ties with their past idolatrous practices. And that fear of separating those ties, and I think that's essentially what it is in the end, it's a fear, is putting other brethren in jeopardy. And it's putting the Corinthians, who want to continue those associations, also in jeopardy. Back in chapter 6, verses 15 through 18, we noticed just in passing this morning that one of the moral issues in the congregation was an apparent attraction to ritual prostitution. In chapter 6, verse 15 and following, "Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? Certainly not. Or do you not know that he who is joined to a harlot is one body with her? For the two, he says, shall become one flesh, but he who is joined to the Lord is one spirit with him. Flee sexual immorality. Every sin that a man does is outside the body, but he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body." And so there's one manifestation of this attraction toward the idolatry of the past. But as we said, Paul doesn't deal in detail with this attraction till you come to chapter 8. And because there were some who wanted to retain some of these associations and some of these practices, a couple of problems were arising. Number one, in verse 7, of chapter 8. He's talking about strong brethren who have come to understand that an idol is nothing. There's no substance to it. There's no being to it. No personality to it. So the strong feels that he can associate in various contexts with idolatry and remain unstained, unpolluted. But he says in verse 7, "However, there is not in everyone that knowledge. For some, with consciousness of the idol, until now eat it as a thing offered to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled." There's a disparity of understanding in Corinth, just like there is in any congregation. Some understand a little bit better the truth and can apply it in ways that makes them stronger and makes them able to act in a variety of circumstances and correctly, not seeing a spiritual threat there. There are others, however, that aren't that confident. They aren't that sure of themselves and sure of their knowledge. And so they might be persuaded to go ahead and act in a way that violates their conscience, though on one level, I think they understand there's only one God. But their confidence hasn't caught up with their knowledge. And so they're emboldened to eat things sacrificed to idols or to otherwise have the concept that this meat has been offered to an idol and thus is somehow spoiled or tainted by that. And so they're defiling their conscience, falling into sin. Well, it's the example of the strong that's doing that. And so what he says in verses 11 and 12 about this situation is very strong. Chapter 8, verse 11. "Because of your knowledge," speaking to the strong brother, "because of your knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died." So by the sin of violating one's conscience, the soul is being destroyed if that sin is not corrected, repented of. But on top of that, verse 12, but when you thus sin against the brethren and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. So we got a dual problem here. The strong set the example for the weak to violate their conscience. They sin, violate their conscience. They're destroyed spiritually. But the strong brother who set the example and, as it were, pushed the weak brother over the cliff, now he himself has fallen into condemnation because he has made the one for whom Christ died die again. Paul then, because of this circumstance, addresses most of his comments in chapters 8, 9, and 10 to the strong brethren. What was it they were overlooking? Where was the fault in their behavior to go ahead and assert themselves even to the detriment or the destruction of their weaker brother? And it's in this overall context that Paul says some of the things that we talked about this morning. He says you need to have greater consideration for your brethren. And this is where he's heading toward chapter 13 to talk about love, which we looked at this morning. If we're going to have the proper behavior, if we're going to make the right choices and do the right things, knowledge alone isn't enough. He says in the beginning of chapter 8, knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. Love asks the question, how's my behavior going to impact my brother? Love will ask that question, knowledge won't. Knowledge will say, I have the right to do it, get out of my way. And there's an arrogant, selfish, self-directed outlook and that sort of an attitude. And so here's what Paul says in chapter 9 about his own outlook on things. Now, in that broader context, you have in the beginning of chapter 9 a discussion about supporting preachers. It's important to see the context there. He doesn't just decide he's going to talk about preacher support in the middle of this epistle. He's using this as an illustration of the principle. And what he says is, preachers have the right to be supported for the work that they do. I have that right, Paul says. But he establishes the right in order to tell why he gives up the right. And what he's trying to say to these brethren is, self-sacrifice is a necessary part of being a Christian. We don't have the right to assert our rights and trample over other people and set examples that can hurt other people and just simply act like we're an island unto ourselves, that we exist in a vacuum. Paul says, I give up being with you here in Corinth. I give up my right to be supported by you. 2 Corinthians, he says, I robbed other churches to do you service. But here's what he says about his attitude in chapter 9 and verse 12. If others are partakers of this right over you, are we not even more? This is the right to be supported. Nevertheless, we have not used this right, but endure all things, lest we hinder the gospel of Christ. So Paul says, I'm looking outside of myself. It's not about Paul. It's not about me. It's about the gospel. And I don't want to do anything to hinder it. So in this case, in Corinth, I think the best judgment here is to not receive support from you while I work there. In chapter 9, then in verse 19, we read this morning. For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win the more. Then down in verse 23, now this I do for the gospel's sake, that I may be a partaker of it with you. That's after he said, I've become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some, in the preceding verse. Paul's attitude is outward. It is directed toward the sake of the gospel, and that's not just some principle floating out there, some abstract idea. It's so that the gospel can be preached without interference and people would have the best chance of obeying that gospel. And so, as we stressed in the lesson this morning, Paul is trying to get the Corinthians to quit looking at themselves and look outward and consider other people, whether it's other weak brethren. Don't trample them underfoot so that they violate their conscience, sin against Christ, and you're lost and they're lost. Or whether it's in the context here of chapter 9, verses 19 through 23. To the Jew, I become a Jew. To the Greek, I become a Greek. To those without law, not under law. I am trying to conform myself within limits That is, in obeying Christ first. I'm trying to conform myself to the scruples and the opinions and the judgments and the beliefs of all other people so that I can possibly save some. Again, this outward view. However, I want us to focus on verses 24 through 27 because Paul changes his tack just a little bit. He's still concerned about getting this selfless message out to the Corinthians. But there's something even more fundamental than that. And what he's going to say here is, we first of all have to, within our own selves, have a desire to be saved and a desire to be right in the sight of God and to be disciplined in that desire so that that's the most important thing in life. And if we have that kind of disciplined desire to be with the Lord, to be obedient, to be people of faith, then out of that attitude is going to grow this concern for other people. So this is what he says in verse 24. Chapter 9. Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. Therefore I run thus, not with uncertainty. Thus I fight, not as one who beats the air, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified. I want you to notice the phrase in verse 24, do you not know? We read that back in chapter 6 a couple of times, just a few minutes ago. Do you not know? Paul uses this phrase 10 times in 1 Corinthians. And it'd be a pretty good study to go back and take your concordance and look at those and see what he's trying to say to them. But I think the underlying attitude here is one of some biting sarcasm. Oh, you Corinthians that seem to know everything? Do you not know? What he's saying to them is, do I have to tell you this? I thought you were spiritual giants. I thought you knew everything. I thought you had all knowledge and all prophecy and you had all the gifts to the greatest degree. Do you not know? And he says that over and over and over in the book. He's chiding them. This is something you ought to know. And beyond just their possession of the gifts, using an athletic illustration here, they had some games that were held, the Isthmian Games, held in their vicinity. I think it was every couple of years. But athletics were woven into their culture. And he's going to draw this illustration from the field of athletics to say something about spiritual intensity. And he says, do you not understand this? Do you not get this principle? Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? And so, first of all, he says to them, in regard to our spiritual pursuits, there must be focus. And he's using the idea of the runner who is in the race and only one wins. Now, carrying the analogy too far is going to end up in a problem here. Because he's not saying only one's going to get to heaven. But what he's saying is we need to have the focus that is similar to the runner who has his eyes on the prize. And he says that these people in the games, in the athletic games, have such concentrated focus. And he says everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. And he says they're doing it, in verse 25, for a perishable crown. And so he mentions two things here, two principles, focus and discipline. The one obviously leads to the other. If you're focused on the prize, in this case, in the physical athletics, he's talking about a crown of branches, leaves. That's what they were competing for. That was the visible prize. And he says those who have that prize in their sight are self-disciplined. They're temperate in all things. Of course, they weren't only competing for the grass crown. They were competing in their day for some of the same reasons that people compete in athletics in our day. It's for all the goodies that go along with it. Because if you're the winner, you get acclaim, you get probably money and favors and all sorts of opportunities that would not come to others. But nonetheless, what he's indicating here is there are people in this world who discipline themselves, who sacrifice. They sacrifice their social lives. They sacrifice the things they want to eat. They sacrifice all the other things they could be doing, and they concentrate solely and wholly on gaining that prize or gaining the perishable crown. As an illustration of that, you ever see an athlete who's quit competing? Most of them, if they've been out of competition for a year or two, have put on a lot of weight. They're not working out like they used to, and so they begin to look like the rest of us. It takes great effort, which we take for granted when we see a bunch of guys on the football field. They all look alike, chiseled out of granite, you know, and strong and fast, and they all look alike, so you don't really pay any attention to it until you see one who's quit playing. And then you begin to realize, well, how much discipline it takes, how much effort it takes to maintain that honed physical condition so that you can compete on that level. And his point is, if men do that for the perishable crown, if they exercise such discipline to achieve things in this life only, what about us as we compete for a spiritual crown? They do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable one. Paul makes the application to himself. He says in verse 26, "Therefore I run thus, not with uncertainty." I'm not just aimlessly wandering around. And one of the races that amazes me is the 100-meter dash sprint. These fellas, they train and they train and they train and lift weights and work out, and it's over in about 9.5 to 10 seconds. Upper eight and the lower nine. I mean, every bit of focus. And if you're thinking of the Olympics, all the years that have gone into that training, and you know, you watch them lining up to get ready to run the race, there's only one thing they have in mind. It's the finish line, and it's getting there first. And all of that training and all of that focus and all of that effort and all of that sacrifice is over like that. They've got a purpose. They've got a name. They've got a focus. And Paul says, so do I. I run thus not with uncertainty. Thus I fight, not as one who beats the air. I'm not just wildly flailing about hoping I hit something. Or I'm not just out here running blindfolded and hope I cross the finish line first. I discipline my body, he says in verse 27. I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified. Paul says, I discipline my body and bring it into subjection. And I think he does that because he knows something about himself that we all know about ourselves. Paul has tendencies, Paul has weaknesses that would undermine his spirituality if he ran an undisciplined race, if he fought an undisciplined fight, if he wasn't focused and he wasn't determined. If he did not have the kind of self-sacrifice that an athlete demonstrates, he says, I myself would become disqualified. And disqualified means you're no longer in the race. And Paul realized that that certainly could happen in his case. Does this kind of focus and this kind of determination describe your spiritual life? If we're able to do what we do day in and day out normally, the only way we're going to do it even those of us that might not be so disciplined about things, we still have to live a disciplined life. If you're going to get up and go to work every morning, you've got to go to bed at some kind of a reasonable hour. Get enough sleep that you can stay awake and focus on your job and hold that job and be productive. If you're going to have something to eat when supper time rolls around, somebody's going to have to have thought about things ahead of time and shop. If you're going to have any money at the end of the month, you're going to have some kind of discipline in how you handle your finances. If we don't have some sort of discipline in how we approach our everyday life, not many of us can relate to the athletic world. But we all have to get through day by day by day. We have to go to work. We have to eat. We have to sleep. We have to make sure we've got clean clothes. There's just a lot of things that need to be done that we've got to have some kind of discipline for. So even those of us that might consider ourselves not so disciplined do demonstrate quite a high level of discipline if you stop and think about it. Do you show that kind of discipline? Do I show that kind of discipline in my spiritual life? Am I that focused? As focused as I would be about my job and about eating and about wearing clothes and my banking? What about your inner strength of conviction and the spiritual focus? Is it there? Is it there like the 100-meter dash runner who is just so intently focused on the finish line? Would you describe yourself spiritually as being singular in purpose? And in Paul's terminology, that would be to obtain an imperishable crown. Is that really the focus of your life spiritually? That you, if someone were to ask you to describe it, that you could say, I'm straining and working and sacrificing and disciplining myself spiritually so that I gain the prize. I mean, is that your conscious thought? Is it your focus personally? You know, we talked this morning about we know how to go through the motions. We know how to do the routine, the religious routine. Is your faith yours? Is your focus yours? Or is it generated by someone else? Do you go through those motions because of other people in your life that sort of shepherd you in that way? And don't get me wrong, we ought to be grateful for all the encouragement that we get, whoever it comes from. But at the end of the day, somewhere, my faith has to be mine. Not my wife's, not my husband's, not my father's, not fear of the elders, not the preacher preaching at me, not some social image. I've got to be convicted. I've got to have the focus that the runner's got, that Paul said that he had. Are you disciplined in your Bible study? Are you disciplined in attendance at worship? Are you disciplined at arriving at worship or Bible class on time? Do you demonstrate focus and determination and discipline? Even, yes, into the small things. Being here when we're supposed to be here so that we're not a disruption to everybody else. Walking in late. From time to time, we have announcements made. We had 340 in Bible class. Could we all move in? How does that announcement strike you? I ain't going nowhere. Going to sit right here. It's my spot. Or do you say, like Paul, I'm all things, all men. There may be a visitor coming in and in an embarrassing situation. We've had visitors being led all the way to this front pew over here before. And maybe it's because all the pews in the back were full. But it can be embarrassing if someone who's unfamiliar to us comes in and can't find a spot. We've been asked to move. I mean, is there a consideration for other people? That even in something very small like that would make us say, you know, I want to make people feel welcome, so I'll be happy to move if it gives room to someone else to come sit and worship. Can you overcome your fears and anxieties like so many of our young men, I'm sure, did this morning? Because they've got something to contribute. Because you have something to contribute. Can I work to overcome that and develop a skill or a gift that God has given to me, as we talked about last week? Am I willing to spend one or two nights a month visiting, just on a rotation basis, finding one person a month to go visit, spend one of my nights? And, you know, we could multiply these suggestions, but all I'm trying to get you to see is the issue of spiritual focus and discipline, and to what degree does it exist in your life, and what degree does it exist in mine. And you know, Paul was a great apostle, and he had great gifts and appearances of the Lord and revelations and whatnot, but you know, the Lord doesn't help Paul with this. Verses 26 and 27, that's from Paul. It has nothing to do with being an apostle. It has everything to do with his singular desire to be pleasing unto God and to go to heaven. That's Paul, unadorned and unstripped of apostleship. And so we can't just say, well, you know, I can't compare myself to the apostle Paul because I'm not an apostle. Well, he's not speaking here about being an apostle. He's speaking just about Paul. And he says, I want to go to heaven worse than anything else. Now, excuse me, with those thoughts in mind, I'd like us to look just briefly at chapter 10. I'm not going to deal with verses 1 through 11 because we've had Marty give us a little exposition on that. And our last singing night, we had an exposition on this as well, regarding the failures of the Israelites after they'd come out of Egypt. So we're not going to deal with that. All I'm going to say is Paul in those verses reviews Israel's history to bring some historical perspective to the Corinthians, because what he's saying to them is, you remember the Israelites? You're making the same mistake that they made. They found it hard to give up Egypt. They found it hard to let go of the Egyptian gods they got so used to. They found it hard to let go of knowing where the next square meal was coming from and then depending on God for everything in the wilderness, and they kept looking backwards and looking backwards and looking backwards. And what are the Corinthians doing? They're looking backwards. They were raised in an idolatrous city with idolatrous practices and idolatrous habits, and family and friends and co-workers still an idolatry. And they're being drawn to it. Oh, well, you know, I know there's no such thing as an idol, but boy, I'd sure like to be with my friends Friday night at the idol temple, 7:30, you know. Got to be there. The ESPN games are in town, you know, and we've got some sports to talk about. These people are not so different than us. And they're afraid. They're afraid to let go of the past. And so, what do you see happening? An attraction to temple prostitution? A desire to go into the temples and eat meat sacrificed to idols? To buy the meat that's been sacrificed to idols in the marketplace? To go to your neighbor's house and making no distinction, sit down and eat the meat sacrificed to idols? Those things are all being dealt with by Paul here. Now, on that basis, let's look at verses 12 and 13, chapter 10. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall. The obvious warning here is against overconfidence. And I want to make this point about let him who thinks he stands. I think what Paul is saying contextually is, if you think you stand by your own merits, if you think you stand by your own excellence, if you think you stand by your own achievement, I don't think he's saying here that we ought to walk perpetually through life in doubt about our eternal salvation. That isn't the point. That's not the context at all. What he's having to say to the Corinthians over and over and over again, he says to people who are arrogant, self-assured, confident, boastful, feeling superior, and he says to people of that kind of an attitude, if you think you stand, you better watch out. We can have confidence, should have confidence. We've covered this in other lessons. But the confidence doesn't reside within us. It's not centered in us. It's centered in the grace of God and the sacrifice of Jesus and the ability of His blood to wash away our sins and the love of God to make us His children. That's where the confidence lies. But I think he's talking to people who are self-confident. And he says, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. What is it about being overconfident that leads to falling? Why sometimes does the best team lose? The best athlete loses. But I think basically because overconfidence distorts the truth. When we're overconfident, we are not looking at things realistically. Number one, we've inflated our abilities. We think more highly of ourselves. We think we've got more ability, more resource, more gift than we actually have. And we then undervalue the opposition. And the two sometimes are fatal in terms of competition. We're not looking at things realistically anymore. We're not paying attention to the enemy. And so often, by mere inattention or by overconfidence, we fall. And Paul says, this is where you're headed, to the Corinthians. They're afraid to let go, put their past behind them, and to have their allegiance fully centered on Jesus Christ. Thus leaving the idol's temples behind, leaving the associations that could compromise them or the weak brethren behind, make a clean break with it, and devote themselves fully to Christ. They're afraid to do that. And you know, oftentimes what appears to be overconfidence is a lack of certainty. You meet somebody and they sort of, you know, strut around and they act superior and their nose is in the air. They might walk right past you and never look at you. And you think, what do I do? And that sort of, you know, snooty nose up in the air sort of an attitude oftentimes is insecurity. And I think the Corinthians are insecure. They're insecure about their past. They're not quite willing to completely cut it off and let it go. And it's that insecurity that leads them to over-exaggerate their abilities. It's what people do. They're overcompensating for their insecurity, so they strut around and vaunt themselves, as he talks about in chapter 13. Build themselves up, because at the heart of it, there's an inner insecurity. And I think that's what's happening to these people. And so Paul then says this in verse 13, relative to overcoming temptations. There are three assurances he gives them to help give them confidence in the right thing, not in themselves, but in God. No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. We all tend to look at ourselves as being different. Oh, yeah, I know so-and-so, but my situation is different. I know they're going through something, but I'm just different. You know, mine is so much worse than their situation. I don't think I can handle it. I don't think I can make a clean break, you know. After all my co-workers and my family and my friends, they're all still idolaters. And I just don't think the Lord would expect me to make a clean break with this. I think that's asking a little too much. And Paul says, no temptation's overtaken you except such as is common to man. God expected the Israelites to do the same thing. Cut off the idolatrous association. And they weren't willing to do it either, for whatever excuse. And the Corinthians are struggling with that. So, here's one assurance. All temptations are common to man. You're not any different. I'm not any different. Don't, you know, no, woe is me, woe is me. No, you know, it happens to everybody. We have the same weaknesses. We face the same struggles. We have the same challenges. Oh, it may come in fits and starts, and things may go in cycles, but we're not unique. You can do this, Paul is saying to them. Secondly, God governs temptations and limits them to what we can stand. Boy, we're challenged to believe that sometimes, aren't we? How am I doing here? A fellow I know who preaches in Prague. Let me tell you, just his last month. Young man in the Czech Republic, Christian, found a young woman in the state of Florida, Christian. They decided to get married. They were going to get married Thanksgiving weekend. So he comes over. The fellow who preaches in Prague, his name is Mike Morrow from the state of Alabama. Mike has married a Czech woman. They make the trip over for the wedding. Over Thanksgiving, Mike and his wife, Tatiana, hear that Tatiana's sister back in the Czech Republic has been tragically killed. This is one, you know, you just can't believe it. There was some glass over her doorway in the house where she lived. I don't know the details. I just know the general story. But somehow, whether by shutting the door or whatever, the glass fell out, cut her jugular vein. She died in front of her 15-year-old daughter in about 2 minutes flat. Bled to death. Mike and Tatiana are here for the wedding. They hear about the death of Tatiana's sister. They scrounge around and get some tickets and go back to Prague. While they're there, Mike's father in Russellville, Alabama, has a heart attack. Dies in 2 days. And so now, Tatiana's sister has died. She was also the caretaker of the mother. She had a 15-year-old daughter. Mike's father is dead. Mike and Tatiana have now inherited a 15-year-old niece and Tatiana's mother to take care of, and Mike is here trying to help his mother deal with the death of his father. When it rains, it pours. It happens. It happens to good people. It happens when we didn't do anything to deserve it. Sometimes life piles on and piles on and piles on and piles on, and then we read, oh, no temptation is overtaking you, such as is common to man, and God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able. Sometimes we wonder what we're able to handle. But I'm telling you, belief in that truth right there is going to be put into practice in our lives at some point. I feel fairly certain. Is that true? We might believe, you know, God's word readily on baptism as immersion and it's necessary for the remission of sins, but what about when life has dumped on me and I don't think I can take it anymore and it dumps on me again, and then I turn and read that God is faithful and He will not allow me to be tempted beyond what I'm able. Believing that verse takes on a whole new meaning. But nonetheless, that's what it says. God's judgment is better than mine. God's view of me is clearer than my view of myself. And believing that truth and being committed to the God whom Paul is talking about is going to be the secret of getting us through a lot of tragedy and difficulty in this life. Nonetheless, we're sure God governs temptations and trials and will not allow us to be tempted beyond what we're able. And then we have this final word of assurance. But with the temptation will also make the way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. Whether it's a temptation to sin or whether it's a trial of life, in the case of the Corinthians, I think specifically it's this temptation to hang on to idolatry. God will make a way for you. You do what is right and you let go of what is sinful and what is wrong and you make a clean break. Don't compromise. Don't give God half and this other situation half. Don't compromise. Do what is right. Do you not think that God will make a way somehow? Will open another door? Take care of you in some other way that might not be apparent on the face of it? There must, before we can be concerned about others, there must be a basic concern for our own welfare and our own salvation. Paul says, I might be disqualified, and I don't want that. And I'm going to do everything I can to see that I'm not disqualified after I've preached to others. That was central to Paul's outlook. I want to go to heaven. I want to be saved. And then secondarily to that, but certainly attached, is I want to take everybody else I can. I want to become all things to all men that I might save some. Because that's the nature of God, and that's the character of God, and that's the desire and the will of God for me in my life, whether an Apostle Paul or whether Jim Jonas or Marty Broadwell or whoever it may be. God is desiring for us to live the right kind of a life before men and take advantage of opportunities that may come to influence them so that we might draw them closer to the gospel, to have an opportunity to present it to them. And so we see in this lesson tonight and the one even today, Paul is getting at the very heart of what it means to be a Christian, to be a servant of God, to have love in our hearts for others and concern for them, but concern for ourselves, and having focus and discipline to desire to be in heaven. Is that your deepest desire? We certainly hope and pray that it is. And if it is, and there's something amiss in your life that we can help you correct, would you come and express that as we stand and sing?